Time now for hour number two in this weekend's big two-hour get-together here on A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, interviewing Karen Kondazian. She's appeared as a series regular lead in CBS's Shannon and guest starred in over 50 television shows and films, including TNT's James Dean with James Franco, NYPD Blue, Frasier, and Yes, Giorgio with Luciano Pavarotti. She's going to talk about her book titled The Whip, published by Hansen Publishing Group.
Now, what an intriguing story. So how did you get involved in writing about a remarkable woman born Charlotte Parkhurst?
I remember many years ago I used to read Cosmopolitan magazine to find a man, and I remember once there was this article, and it was very interesting about women of the Wild West. And they had written about Charlie Parker's Charlotte. And I thought, my God, at that time, you know, I'd never heard of that ever happening, which later after I'd done research, I realized that a lot of women, particularly in the 1800s and particularly in the Old West, put on men's clothes. For many reasons, obviously to be able to travel safely. Also, the ones that were free-spirited. There were women, I don't know if you know this, Carol, but there were women who actually fought in the Civil War. Men, nobody ever knew that they were women, and then they went home and had three children.
That's just amazing. So how long did it take you to write the book, and where did you find the energy? Because I know you did a lot of research. And
yes.
My last question is, why do you call it historical fiction?
Okay, I'll answer the historical fiction first. It's historical fiction because, first of all, it is, obviously, it's based on a true story. Charlotte Parkhurst is buried in Watsonville, California, which is near Santa Cruz, near San Francisco. She's in the Oddfellow Cemetery of all
places. That makes me laugh.
By the way, was only for men, and it was a charity group, and they invited her to be a member. And so I took all the facts of her life, and then, because obviously if we're going to read a story, we need to care about the characters. So we don't know much about her other than the facts that she was probably the first woman to vote in America as a man, that she was a famous stagecoach driver for Wells Fargo, that she killed the famous outlaw Sugarfoot, who robbed his stagecoach one too many times, and that she had had a baby. So I made a love story. I went to Watsonville and talked to some people who were experts in her life, and took the rumors that we know about her, and I fictionalized the rumors. So there's a difference between facts, obviously, and rumors, and you know, Carol, history. I mean, we don't know, even Lincoln to this day, there are all kinds of things where people say, yes, this happened, and know that. We can't tell with fiction. So it's called historical fiction because it is fiction, but it's based on a true story. Now, to go back to your question about how long and why I took it on, the book, was after reading this article, she kind of haunted me. She stayed in my head, and I just had so many questions. I had questions like, she didn't have a beard. How would she carry off the physicality of being a man without being discovered? How did she do things like, you know, those guys, Carol, I'm sure you're aware of, were very macho, and they all hung together, the stagecoach drivers. And, I mean, how did she pee? I mean, you know, how did she do that? How did she do simple things like that? How did she have a period? All those things that we as women know would be a difficult, especially when you're a younger person, meaning, you know, you're not menopausal anymore. You're not past that time. How do you? That would hurt. That would make me very uncomfortable bouncing along on the trail. So, you know, I had to answer those questions. So it took me 6 years and 27 drafts, and Charlie is now in a book.
and you know, she's mesmerizing. And how in the world was she able, as the stagecoach driver, the whip, how was she able to handle six horses that she had to get from one destination to another?
Apparently, from the research that I did, she was an expert horsewoman and had been trained by a man who was sort of like her father. And we don't know whether he knew she was dressed as a man then. We don't know whether he knew or didn't know that she was a woman. All we do know is that she became brilliant with horses. And I don't know if you know, and I don't know if the audiences know, but to drive a team, you didn't really have to be strong. You just had to know horses. You had to be able to manipulate all these reins. There were a rein for each horse. And that's really why she was able to do it. But I know she took on a job, you know, if you're going to be a, I think it was Albert Nobbs that Glenn Close did the movie of, which I don't think was the true story, but there were women just like Albert Nobbs. And, you know, you take on a, if I was going to do that, I'd take on a job like that. I'd be a servant or something. I mean, she just was out there, you know, just, she also, this is another funny thing. Apparently, she was a great chopper of trees. She made money that way. I've never really talked about this, but there's things she did that I didn't put into the book because it just didn't follow the story. It would, the subplot would go out and, you know, it would not be appropriate for the story I was telling. But she also owned a bar. She did many things. She was amazing. And she lived to be 67 years old, which at that time was pretty old.
Right. And, you know, I think that things were so limited for women back then. I mean, you could be a wife, I think, teacher, or prostitute. So she really, you know, it's important that we know what women could do and what some women were driven to do.
Yes.
To fulfill their dreams.
That's exactly right. You hit it right on the nose. You know, you couldn't have dreams as a woman. You just had to fall in line, marry a man, have children, help on the farm if it was a farm, or help with the store if it was in the city. And that was it. Men could go out and, you know, do whatever was in their minds to do. And so if you were free-spirited, you were in trouble. So, yeah, it was a very different time. And I'm very grateful to be living now because I would imagine I would be putting on men's breeches and, you know, seeing the world. I don't know about
Me
you.
Too.
What would you be doing, Carol?
I would not be in those worlds. You can bet on that. And gosh, and getting back to Charlie, wasn't she also the first woman to vote in an election?
Yes, as far as we know, that's what is on her tombstone. And apparently she voted for General Grant, of course, as a man. An interesting little fact is she died of tongue cancer, mouth cancer, from chewing tobacco, too many cigars and liquor, and so did General Grant. The man she voted for died of exactly the same thing. But as far as we know, we only have notation on paper with her signature that she voted that one time. But, you know, she may have voted other times as well, and we just don't have the notation of it.
And our listeners will have to read the book. It's so interesting, and it asks another important question about forgiveness, and that's a theme that runs through the book, and that makes it important for that reason also.
Yes. In fact, I have a question to ask you and the listeners, and that is the theme of the book. And the question is, if someone destroyed horribly everybody and everything that you love in this world, could you forgive them?
No. That's my answer. But everybody's different, right?
Yeah, and if you couldn't, how far would you go?
That I don't know.
Yeah. Well, do you remember the doctor? There was a doctor in Connecticut, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, maybe
oh,
a little
yes.
more, whose family, horrible, horrible. His two daughters and his wife were raped and burnt, tied to their beds and burnt to death, and they thought he was dead, and he crawled out the back door. And later, after the trial, I know these men are going to be put to death, these two monsters, but they asked him, could he forgive them now that this was all done, the trial and everything, and he said, I cannot forgive evil.
That's Karen Kondazian in conversation with Carol Marx. Her book is titled The Whip, and it's published by the Hansen Publishing Group. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marx, in conversation with Dr. Carl O. Helvey. He's a registered nurse with two masters and a doctorate in public health and wellness. He's going to discuss with Carol his inspiring book titled, You Can Beat Lung Cancer, Using Alternative Integrative Interventions. It's published by INE Books.
What are a few of the important statistics about lung cancer that people should know in the United States and the world?
Well, first of all, most people think of breast cancer, prostate cancer, as the major cause of death, but this is not true. Lung cancer causes more deaths than breast, prostate, and colon cancer combined. And they estimate that one out of every four people in the United States will have lung cancer at some point during their lifetime.
That's amazing, because I really never knew that. Now, we all know that the major cause of lung cancer is smoking. What are some of the other causes, and can there be multiple factors such as age, health, attitudes, and emotions that also can predispose somebody?
Right. The statistics say 89% for smoking, 3% secondary smoke, about 2% for radon, a little bit for asbestos, and a little bit unknown. But I believe in a holistic approach, and with a public health background, I know that there are multiple things that lead up to any disease process, so you're right. There are things other than smoking that cause this. You know, the person may smoke, but they may run down their immune system by their lifestyle, and their diet may be inadequate. They may not be very optimistic. There's a whole gamut of things that lead up to that process we call cancer.
Now, let's talk about your personal experience with lung cancer. How many years ago were you given this diagnosis? How old were you, and how long were you given to live?
It was 38 years ago. I think I was 44, and the doctor told me I would be dead in 6 months. And so, you know, they wanted to do surgery and chemotherapy.
And now you're a youngin' at 80. So looking back on your experience, why do you believe that you got lung cancer, and what led you to think outside the box when it came to treating it?
I believe that everything happens for a reason, and everything happens for the best. And when I look back at it, I believe that I had lung cancer so that at this point in my life, I'm able to offer encouragement to other people when the doctor tells them they've got 3 months or they've got 6 months. And I also can help them find medical resources that will treat them naturally instead of the harsh chemicals that traditional medicine typically uses.
And how did your family and your nursing and medical colleagues react to your decision not to go that traditional route of surgery, radiation, and chemo?
None of them supported me. And my mother, who I know loved me very much, said, well, why don't you just do what the doctor wants you to do, and then you do these other things. My colleagues, being all nurses, they all felt the same. And I think that back then it was very typical. The doctor has all the answers. He's almost like God. You do what the doctor tells you. But I tended never to be very typical.
You went the alternative holistic route. So what was your regimen, and after 2 years, what happened to the tumor?
Well, the reason I did this was I did not want to be debilitated for my last 6 months on Earth, if this was to be a six-month sentence. And after 2 years, I went to my primary doctor who had followed me every 3 months, but I didn't tell him I was doing anything, so he thought we were in a wait-and-see mode. And after 2 years, he said the spot was gone, and he guessed they had made the wrong diagnosis. But my friend, who was the director for Blue Cross Blue Shield in North Carolina, wanted to look at all of the tests, and so I took all of the tests to North Carolina, and he confirmed a third time that it definitely was lung cancer.
Now, what was the regimen that you used over those 2 years?
I used Laetrile, which was illegal at the time, but my doctor told me where I could get it. I used pancreatic enzymes. I ate apricot kernels, about 25 every day, which is also a big source of Laetrile. I took a lot of supplements like vitamin A, a therapeutic dose, vitamin E. I took several vitamin Bs. I was on a very special diet that was 75% raw fruit and vegetables with some additional cooked fruit and vegetables, grain, and nuts, except peanuts. Peanuts are a high source of protein. I could not have protein, and I couldn't have simple sugar. It's basically what people now call a vegan diet. And to this, I added prayer, meditation, visualization, affirmation, a variety of mental and spiritual interventions, because I believe in a holistic approach.
Now, you use dietary supplements to support your cancer treatment. There are so many out there. Where would a person start? Can you name one or two?
Well, one thing that I used was vitamin A, and I used 300,000 international units the first week, 150,000 international units the second, and then 50,000 thereafter. And as you know, 5,000 is the recommended daily dose, and it also is one of the fat-soluble vitamins, so that the excess is not excreted, it's stored in the body. So it was a little bit of a concern. But the reason that was prescribed is that it's believed that vitamin A in therapeutic doses keep the normal cells from turning to cancer cells, and also is part of the treatment for killing the cancer cells. And then vitamin C, which is a big therapy now, but at that time I was taking 20,000 milligram a day. But now they take huge doses and give it IV. And when this comes in contact with the cancer cells, it converts to hydrogen peroxide, and it kills the cancer cells, but does not affect the normal cells.
You're 80 years young, as I said, and you have no chronic illnesses, or are you taking prescribed medications? So what have you done to prevent a recurrence of cancer and maintain your good health?
I pretty much followed the same lifestyle, Carol, that I followed when I had cancer. Now, I have added some chicken, a little bit of fish, but I hesitate on fish much because of the mercury levels. I don't eat farm-grown salmon because of toxins. And so I continued eating primarily fruit and vegetables and nuts and grains. I walk every day. I'm optimistic. I pray every day. I use affirmations when appropriate. When I have a medical condition, the doctor will prescribe something. I usually throw that away because I don't like those chemicals in my body, and I find something natural to use with things. And so it's pretty much the same lifestyle that I had before.
Now, you write that more people are moving toward alternative integrative treatments for cancer, and that is a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that many mainstream practitioners of conventional medicine still are not using alternative integrative treatments?
Well, cancer is a multi-billion dollar industry. The drug companies make lots of money. The doctors buy chemotherapy wholesale. They administer it and charge retail. They get paid for administering it. The cancer societies stay open because people are paying for it. Hospitals get wings donated. I could go on and on and on. But there is not a lot of interest in doing much about it because it keeps the health industry going.
And one of the wonderful things about your book is that you talk about all the, you know, the vitamins and the supplements and the enzymes, and you describe how much you need to take them and exactly what they do. So what is the message that you hope readers of your book will come away with?
I hope that they will know that when they're faced with the diagnosis of cancer and the doctor says, I can offer you chemo, surgery, and radiation, that they will have the knowledge to know that there are other alternatives and that they do not have to jump and take one of these. If they prefer that, that's fine. But I want people to know that there are alternatives and to know and to have the education and the knowledge to make the decision that is right for them.
That's Dr. Carl O. Helvey in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled, You Can Beat Lung Cancer Using Alternative Integrative Interventions, published by Eine Books. For more information, go to the website beatlungcancer.net. More coming your way on The Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we come to the final half hour of our big two-hour weekend get-together, and we're joined, as is customary at this time, by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. And Richard's going to be talking in just a couple of minutes from now with Scott Taylor Smith, who's the author of a book titled When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. It's published by Scribner. And you know something, Richard? I would imagine that this is the kind of book that will never, ever have a chance of being a bestseller.
Well, I'll tell you, when I first heard we were going to do this interview, and I was thinking, oh, my, how depressing is this? But actually, it's not. What it is it's logistics. It talks about making the arrangements. Because, you know, we all, obviously, when someone dies close to us, we go through an emotional turmoil period where we're grieving, we're not thinking straight. And basically what this book does is it kind of sets an outline for things that just need to be done. Funeral arrangements, burial, wills probated, plans to be made prior to. So it's really a very good practical guide just to kind of have around if you have the idea that this is going to happen in the very near future. I mean, obviously sometimes you don't know, it just happens suddenly. But when someone is ill and you know that the end is near, it's a very, very good reference book.
Well, I was going to say, it's probably the kind of book that would sell on the spur of the moment if a person had it have it within 24 hours and then they need something. Because I think that regardless, people don't like to prepare for this. I think most coffins, most funeral plots, most funeral arrangements, most everything having to do with death happens after the fact.
And as a result, you wind up overpaying.
Yes,
you wind
of course.
Up being taken advantage of. You you wind up not having your ducks in a row, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you on the other side of this, my theory about why people wait until they overpay. I'll explain that. But first, we have this coming up, and let's not waste any more time. Quick break. And when we come back, Richard Neer will be talking to Scott Taylor Smith, the author of the aforementioned book, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You're age 65, and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, as promised, in conversation with Scott Taylor Smith, the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, published by Scribner.
Scott, you know, I think when people look at when someone dies, they go, oh, my God, what's this all about? Is it about where we go afterwards? Is it some crackpot thing that, you know, there's this rainbow or there's something there or whatever? Oh, I've had enough of that. But it's really about the practical, logistical side of it. And that's something that, boy, you need to prepare for way before it happens, don't you?
Yes, you do. And yes, the book is not a grief book, and it's also not sort of a metaphysical book about where we go. Those topics are handled very well by other people. I wrote this book after my mom died. I was her executor, and I just made a series of horrible mistakes. I ordered only one death certificate when I should have ordered probably 20, and I just made terrible decisions. I went looking for a resource guide that would tell me what the practical things were needed to be done, and I couldn't find one. So I decided to write it.
And Scott, the problem too is you're in grief. You're in a period where your emotions are running rampant, and it's not a good time to make decisions. The decisions should really kind of be laid out beforehand so that you don't have to, as you say, make them under emotional duress.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in a perfect world, we would all be having conversations with our elderly parents and our spouse, and we would be documenting everything before we passed away. And one of the things that we recommend in the book, obviously, is that you collect as much information as possible, as well as documents, the will, the durable power of attorney, and put them in a safe place where people know where they are so that when you pass away, they can be easily found. But the truth is, most people don't do that. A lot of people think that if they write a will on a Tuesday, they're going to pass away on Wednesday by being struck by a bus or something. And so a lot of people die without documents.
And you mentioned something before about the death certificate. You got one and you should have had 20. Just in a microcosm here, tell us why you need that many.
Well, every financial institution, your 401k provider, your bank with your checking account, the post office, Social Security, everybody needs a copy of the death certificate, and they want originals. Now, this is changing to some extent with some companies accepting photocopies, but most still require an original death certificate. Also, if you're going to transfer property from a person's name into your name, the county is going to require a death certificate. So what you want to do is you want to look at how many credit cards, how many accounts a person had, and you need at least that many, and then I would add another four or five for the unexpected.
And that's a good thing when you talk about accounts. It really makes a lot of sense to try to consolidate, doesn't it, toward the end, instead of having money all over the place and in different accounts in different states and different countries, to have it where it can be accessed as easily as possible?
Yes, it's a very good idea. Another very good idea, particularly with your living parents, is to get joint checking authority. In other words, add one of the children to the account so that they can continue to access the cash after the parent passes away. You know, one of the scary things is right after someone passes away, all of these expenses start mounting up. You have to pay for the funeral expenses. You might have a pet. You might have children that have to be taken care of. And being able to find ready access to cash of the deceased is very important. And we outline a number of steps that can help you do that in the book.
And it is really incumbent upon the decedent to make everything as clear as possible. Because I can tell you from personal experience, when my father passed away 2 years ago now, and we're still not settled, that it can tear families apart. If things aren't specified, for example, jewelry, real estate, things that are not just cash, tangible things like that, there are emotional attachments that some members of the family have to than others, and there are disputes, and best thing is to have it down in writing before anything happens.
Oh, absolutely. And to hopefully reach an agreement, who gets the jewelry, who gets the china set, sort of before, you know, mom passes away. One of the things that I do in the book is I try to answer those perennial questions that always come up. And let me give you a couple of quick examples. That one of the most burning questions is, suppose you have a sister who passes away. She was living paycheck to paycheck, which a lot of us do these days. She did not own her house. She rented. And when she dies, she owes $35,000 to Visa and MasterCard. And the question comes up, well, am I, as her brother, liable for her debts? And the answer is emphatically no. And the credit card companies will try to convince you that you have to pay your sister's debts, and you don't. Now, there are only two sort of exceptions to that rule. The first one is if you're a spouse and the debt was incurred for the benefit of the marriage or as a couple, then most states provide that you're responsible as the surviving spouse for the debts incurred for the community. The other exception is, let me change the facts just a little bit, and suppose your sister, right before she passed away, she won the lottery, and she had $100,000 in her checking account, and you intend to take that $100,000. The estate is small enough so it doesn't have to go through probate, and so you just plan on taking that $100,000. In that case, technically, given that she has assets sufficient to pay her debts, you're obligated to pay the credit card company. But those are the only two exceptions to the general rule that you don't have to pay a person's debts.
And you mentioned estate tax, and we look at the federal estate tax, and it's at a fairly high level, so most families don't have to deal with it. But the thing that we don't take into consideration is that a lot of states have estate taxes, and they can go down to pretty small amounts of money, can't they?
They absolutely can. And it's, taxes are very confusing, and as the adage goes, there's nothing. The only two certainties in life are death and taxes. After someone passes away, there's the possibility that there are four returns that are due. First, the person who passed away may have earned income in the year in which they died, which means they still have to file an income tax return for that income, and the executor of the estate is required to do that. Similarly, the estate, during the time that the estate exists, the estate could make money. There, for example, it could collect rent or it could collect the past due salary. And in that case, the estate most likely has an estate tax filing to do for income tax. And then the third one is, as you mentioned, the estate tax. The estate tax taxes the value of the estate. The federal government, it used to be a very low number. Now it's a very high number. It's about $5.3 million. If an estate is worth less than that, there is no estate tax. But if the estate is valued at more than that, then an estate tax on the value of the estate is due. And then finally, you've got the state taxes, where the state has an estate, the value of the state tax that could be due.
Yeah, and that changes, obviously, from state to state. Now, a little bit of practical advice. How, when you have an aging parent who is in fairly good health for their age, how do you approach sitting them down and broaching this subject and saying, look, we really need to talk about it without appearing to be the greedy child?
Well, it's very complicated. You do, a lot of times you do look like the greedy child. I think the most important thing to start with is the durable power of attorney, which is to sit down and say, look, if you have an accident or if you get into, you know, if you fall into unconsciousness, what do you want me to do? What would you like me to do as your son? And do you want to have extraordinary medical care given? Do you want to just have palliative care? What really would make you feel good? If you can have that conversation and write down what they say and then put it into a form of a power of attorney so that you have the authority to make those medical decisions after a person is incapacitated, that's a very good starting point because that's about them and about health. And then I think you can start talking about collecting the documents that really matter, finding the will, talking. And by the way, talking about the will is very important because sometimes people will write a will 5 to 10 years previously, and their circumstances have changed. They may have remarried. They may have had a falling out with one of the children, and they don't want to leave money for them. So looking at updating the documents, but most important is putting them someplace secure where people know where they are. When my mom was in the hospital, one of the issues was, where was my power of attorney? Where was the proof to the hospital that I actually had the authority? Now, in my case, I was fortunate to have it, but you really oftentimes have to walk into the hospital with that power of attorney.
And Scott, I think that the key thing is to eliminate as much as of this is what Dad would have wanted to make it what Dad did want in writing, as opposed to guessing and I knew Dad, and this is what he would have liked. That doesn't work because obviously different siblings have different impressions of what that is.
A lot of times, you know, if you're religious, if you belong to a particular religion, the religion may often specify what is done with the body and the timing of it. But in the absence of that, it's very important to know what the deceased wanted for their memorial, whether they wanted to be cremated, for example. A lot of us are green and environmentalists these days, and putting a body in the ground thoroughly embalmed is a very toxic gesture to the earth. So a lot of us greenies, you know, are opting for cremation.
Scott Taylor Smith, in conversation with Richard Neer. His book is titled When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, published by Scribner. Richard Neer returns for some final commentary as we approach the last segment of our big two-hour get-together this weekend here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, coming up in just a moment.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And we are going to continue our conversation with our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. And, Richard, I had mentioned before your conversation in the last segment with Scott Taylor Smith, the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, that my personal feeling is the reason that most people wait most of the time until after the fact is I think that people are superstitious. And I think that people are afraid that if you buy a plot or you arrange for a funeral, somehow you will cause the cosmic winds to blow in that direction and increase your chances of having, you know, the unthinkable happen.
Well, I also think that most of us haven't come to the real acceptance. I mean, we know that it's inevitable that it's going to happen. But we always hold out this thing that, well, you know, maybe we can cheat it. We can postpone it. We can put it off. And maybe by the time we're ready, there'll be some medical advance. You know, Walt Disney supposedly has his head frozen cryogenically. Ted Williams, you know, that we can keep this from happening. And you're right. If we plan for it, if we make arrangements, well, then we're acknowledging that, well, it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah. I saw on the Science Channel, on one of the documentaries, and I can't remember his name or who it is, but there's a scientist who is convinced that within the next 30 years or some reasonable amount of time in the near future, we're going to make medical and genetic discoveries that will give us the opportunity to increase life indefinitely. So what he is doing is he's living his entire life completely totally, 100% fanatically devoted to longevity. He eats only the healthiest foods. He does everything every minute of the day to avoid creating any type of damage to his body. He doesn't put himself in any dangerous situations. It's amazing, based on the premise that if he can survive another 30 years, 25 years, 40, whatever it is, that he'll live forever.
Well, you know what? I think we may have even had him on the show at one time. I know we did have somebody on that said we could live till 120. We should at least live that long.
Right, right.
And I think it's possible in future generations, maybe in the days of Star Trek 300 years from now, they'll look back like Dr. McCoy. Look at that crude medical science. They actually cut people and did surgery? Ooh.
Well, if it's in Star Trek, it's real because so many... No, seriously. Most of the great scientific breakthroughs of the last 100 years were, you know, foreseen in science fiction by such people as H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, Philip K. Dick. People of that nature, these guys were really prophets. As a matter of fact, there was a show on the Science Channel, Prophets of Science Fiction. I hate to sound like I'm...
Well, how about those little phones that they used to have to communicate when they opened them up? They were those flip phones that 30 years later they came to fruition.
Imagine kids today going, how come they were using cell phones on the Enterprise? You know, it's very funny how a show like Star Trek could be on one level prescient, and on another level, corny. Like the female members of the crew wore 1960s styles cocktail dresses, you know, like cocktail waitresses, or stewardesses when they called them that on Pacific Southwest Airlines. If you ever traveled that airline back in the 70s, they look like cocktail lounge waitresses.
Well, who knows what fashions are going to be like? We remember the collarless things, the uniform type things that people wore in a lot of the science fiction stuff. Who knows? We may be wearing sheer things. We may not be wearing anything then.
We may not even have anything to hide. We have to leave. Unfortunately, this conversation is very interesting, but you know, whatever. I'll call you after the show. Folks, that's Richard Neer. Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you, Beverly Santanello, our producer on the front line, the host of the show, Carol Mark, Steve Wiseman, Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Grey broadcast team. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another 2-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.